Raised on D&D Podcast helps to enrich your family's gaming experience by bringing you interviews with parents, educators, game designers, and influencers. Join us as we delve into the many ways that tabletop role-playing games inspire creativity, develop communication skills, and create long-lasting bonds among players. Your host has been an avid gamer since childhood, and now his kids are being raised on D&D. Here is your host, Nick Cardarelli.
Welcome back, gamers. I'm your host, Nick Cardarelli, and this is Raised on D&D. My next guest is from Belleville, Illinois. He's an actor, historian, model, and internationally accredited stuntman. He has 7 years of experience in HEMA and 6 years in HAMA. He is also the first African-American USA longsword champion. He is training for his next armored mixed martial arts fight in Nashville, Tennessee this June. You know him on Instagram as Simply Samurai. Please welcome Spencer Waddell. Hi, Spencer.
Hi, my friend. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Man, I'm so excited to have you here, Spencer. I love watching your fight videos. It's so, so cool. Before we get into all of that, can you take us back to your very first experience with tabletop role-playing games or Dungeons & Dragons?
I certainly can. Oh, my goodness. For you there, listeners, it's interesting because tabletop gaming and just video games is really what got me into wanting to do sword fighting. And I remember doing it with my best friend, Adam Winkler, my friend, Doug Santiago, who I still see today as well, and my little brother. We were in a community center after hours, and we were playing D&D, just in the room, going through this adventure. I think I was a warrior. My brother didn't, he was really young at the time, so he just played like my little familiar. Like, I think I had a dragon, so he rolled a dice and never did it, fire breath. But it was just a really fun adventure, and now I am where I am because of that.
That is amazing. And what I think is so incredible is that tabletop role-playing games, Dungeons & Dragons, inspires people to pursue so many different creative outlets. And it has inspired you to become this amazing athlete and stuntman. Fast forwarding a little bit from all the way back from the community center to now, you have gone through so many incredible tournaments, championships, swordsman societies. Can you tell us a little bit about that journey becoming Simply Samurai?
Sure. Thank you so much. It's been just a really, really fun ride. Now, looking at it all back, I just kind of work on trying to be like the Bruce Lee of swords. Now, granted, Bruce Lee accomplished so much before he died at the age of 33. I'm turning 38 this year, so I've got a lot to catch up on. But we also have our own journeys, right? So when I found swordplay, actually, was right after I got out of the Air Force, and I was at Ramstein Air Force Base. And my friends were like, you should go to some of the castles, learn how to do historical swordplay. And I just loved it.
And I didn't know you were in the Air Force. Thank you for your service. How long were you in the Air Force for?
2004 to 2008 was when I served. And then from then, I went on to like the SCA, Society of Creative Anachronism, learning really good sword fighting mechanics there. And I learned more about HEMA and historical European or historical African martial arts, where I got to meet such amazing just practitioners such as Damon Stith, who's in Austin, Texas. He actually got to do things with Danny Trejo on like the Deadliest Warrior as far as being like a weapon expert. Yeah, and I got to meet him in person when he came to a sword event called Western Martial Arts Workshop in Illinois, or actually it's in Wisconsin, that my good friend Don Stiers got me into. And I got to meet him in person, pick him up at the airport. And that's another time where I asked him, like, how can I get into teaching this? He's like, just do it. Do your research and talk about it. Just start doing it. And I was like, oh, it sounds so simple, but it's not. And ever since then, I've just really picked up things. I have a weird amalgamation of everything. People talk about why I choose Simply Samurai. I started off with martial arts as a kid. Shonen Ryu and the Japanese culture and samurai culture has always been what's really resonated with me. And I'm a big weeb as far as I love anime. So I just thought samurai culture was really cool. Then my friend in the SCA was like, how would you have gotten into my service? And kind of like a backstory. As for the SCA, we can talk about that more later. But my persona, I was like, how could I have gotten to find the Spanish Moor and do all these things? But I was like, I wonder if there's ever an African samurai. And that's when I stumbled upon Yasuke, the African Samurai. And I was lucky enough to talk to Professor Thomas Lockley who wrote the book Yasuke the African Samurai recently. He just wrote a new book recently during the pandemic times. And once again, people are just like, just do the research, just do it. And just felt really empowered. So here I am on this real life D&D adventure, just trying to soak up whatever I can.
That is incredible. And there's a lot in there that I want to unpack. But first off, I want to say, I too have been a member of the Society of Creative Anachronisms. I'm a member of the Kingdom of Trimeris down here in Florida. And I believe we have a mutual friend, Sir Takamatsu, who was a combat marshal for many, many years. You told me before that you had an encounter with him. Can you share that with us?
Certainly. So those of us who have a samurai persona in the Society of Creative Anachronism, we mostly all know each other, kind of, or at least it's one removed. And I got to meet him, I think it's been now 8 years or so. He's passed with three, sadly, for us, but he's an amazing individual. And back when I was a young squire, I don't think I was even knighted yet, we were in a battle called Gulf Wars, where they have like this whole town built up. We do unchoreographed battles in the SCA, for those of you who don't know. So we're actually fighting, but we fight with bamboo or rattan. So it's it doesn't shatter, it brooms more. But we were doing a big mass battle. I mean, I think it was anywhere from like 100 on 100. We happened to be on the same side. I'm from the mid-realm, which is central Midwest. And we literally had this warrior moment where we broke inside the castle. And it's all about safety. So there's a word we call hold, where that's where people stop and make sure everyone's safe and we go through. Because this game, we need to actually be safe because things can happen. People trip. You don't want to twist angles. But we held in a point after we pushed through and we were literally back to back, like in some kind of samurai movie, and there's people all around us, and we looked at each other. You're not supposed to talk during the hold, because it's like time froze and stood still. But we kind of just looked at each other, and then they said, Leon, we went back to fighting, and we went our separate directions, killed as many people as we could, and then died gloriously. But it was just a memory that I'll never forget, and it's just really cool.
That is a beautiful, beautiful memory. Sir Takamatsu was very dear to me and to my family. And actually, about a month before he passed away, I got to spend some time with him. And he shared a story with me that maybe not a lot of people know. And I want to take the opportunity to share it with you now. We were talking about samurai culture, about he pulled out his historical weapons. My son was very interested at the time, and Taka, like he always had the nature of doing, was being the educator and mentor. And he goes and he pulls out a 28 millimeter miniature of a blue armored samurai. And he tells me that this was his painted miniature from childhood that inspired the persona of Sir Takamatsu. And
that's so cool.
I was just blown away that though he didn't play tabletop role-playing games later in life, that was part of his origin story as well. And so I wanted to let you know how you and Sir Takamatsu shared that Dungeons & Dragons plays a factor into not only your inspiration for becoming real life medieval warriors, but also in the Society of Creative Anachronisms as well. So I think that's amazing. And what a great
that's
story.
So cool.
Thank you, Spencer, for sharing.
No, thank you for sharing as well.
You have gone from the Society of Creative Anachronisms, you've gone into HEMA, which people are very familiar with, which is historical European martial art. For the folks at home, tell us a little bit about HEMA.
Sure. So HEMA is really cool. The fact that we actually have these manuscripts from these ancient masters where we can track what they wrote down, what they practiced, what they did from styles all over Europe. There's amazing German styles between Talhofer and other German longsword styles. So there's so many documents as well from Italian. You have Fiore, the flower of battle, where he talks about all these different stances as well as different animals that he attributes to what we use for strength. So you have the elephant for strength and fortitude, you have the lion for courage, you have the lynx for, I believe it's prudence, but he uses these four animals to help illustrate where we need these strengths when we're fighting. And it's really, really cool. Fiore is one of my favorites, an Italian sword play. And there's just so much to learn from it. And of course, people take this from these written documents. They don't have to have guesswork. This is what they wrote. This is what they did. And then now you can use it to the sport style of fighting, because obviously, well, hopefully, we're not fighting to the death in these instances, but most of the time we're fighting for tournaments, the first score. And that's why I think it's interesting to do these kind of fights, because you can do what I call historical, like, archaeology, because you get to look at these things and then you try it. So you don't have to be like, well, I think this works. And you're like, no, let's go out and do it and be safe and wear the fencing gear and do these things. And it's just been really nice to meet people that are masters in real life these days, from Devin Borman from like Canada. There's so many other names I can think of, but there's people that you actually get a chance to, if you go out there and ask humbly, you can maybe get some time with them, or if not, read the books that they have. Greg Melee is another amazing person that has a lot of books on Fiore as well. And he's actually in Chicago, where I get to go sometimes and actually practice.
That is awesome. Now, these are with live weapons, blunted weapons. What are you using with HEMA?
These are live steel, but we call them not sharp. So they're an unsharpened steel, but they still are actual steel. But you do start out with sometimes with plastic ones. They do have wood. Even no, not being a member of some of these schools that teach, it's like I said, we talk about being humble and almost everything we do and work on. People can look at your resume and then they will have you go through some of the steps, but most of the time people are like, oh, I've seen your things, I trust you with a metal weapon as we go and fight. And we're not there to win practice, right? You're just there to learn, but we get to actually use the metal in as close as how it would work. Now, granted, there is difference. When you do cut tests, you are using a sharpened steel sword. And for some of our viewers at home, we got some swords behind me. But that's different if you were to fight with live swords, which someday I'd like to do more research with that, where people, you are protected. There are some liabilities, but when you actually have the armor and you're working on that, you would be protected. But more, when you have a sharp sword attack, a sharp sword, they bite into each other. So It's different. That's why sometimes people talk about pairing with a flat. That's what's been so interesting in doing all this, is learning the historical aspects of it, doing the sports aspects of it, doing the stunt aspects of it. There's so many different levels of swordplay.
I know there are a lot of people who are listening who, you know, they want to take their love for swordplay, for combat, away from the game table, and they want to take it into the backyard with sticks, and they want to take it to the HEMA court, and they want to do that. Spencer, what would be your advice for the gamers and the gamer families out there who are listening, who want to get away from the table and they want to add a active sports element to their hobby? How would they go about starting?
So we're working on trying to have more of a place that's an easier place for people to go and look to find information, because there's so many things out there. But I'd say Google your local HEMA group is a good place to start. The Society of Creative Anachronism is also great for still learning, but it depends on which group you're in. Not to say one people teach better than another. It's just there's so many different standards, so you may not get the experience you want. For steel and armored combat, or Buhurt or armored combat, go to Start Fighting Info is the way to look. And also, I'm, as Nick can tell you, I'm a nice person. Don't feel bad to reach out to me. Doesn't matter how many followers or how little followers, there's always a bigger fish, always a smaller fish, but you can always reach out to me and I will try to get back to you as soon as possible on simply _samurai on Instagram. I'll try to get better about getting more information like that out to people. But I'd say Google HEMA, looking up there, Google Buhurt or armor combat, people can find. And if you have any questions, feel free to ask and I will be a good marketing person and get you to the right direction. It always makes me happy to hear when people come back to me like, I have a place and thanks to you, I started. And it's not because of me that I love hearing it. I'm just glad they found it. And at last, if you can't, just even picking up a broomstick, picking up a stick, watching some videos, looking at some other things, you can learn how to do swordplay in your own backyard. And you don't have to learn how to fight somebody. There's books. It can be just you versus yourself, which is one of the hardest stories I've ever heard once. Doing MMA, have done Taekwondo, have done all these different martial arts. I remember having one teacher or hearing a story about somebody's like, well, if they don't want to learn how to fight somebody, I think it's a waste of time. And that's one of the greatest disservices, I think, because it can just be something for fitness. It can be something to give you more confidence. And then if you want to get in the ring and fight somebody eventually, sure, that's fine. And most people, it's just fun. We're not actually trying to hurt people. Yeah.
I I think that's great. And I want to share a little story with you as well. So mm-hmm. I have three children. They're little stair steps. They're now they're 18, about to be 17 and 15. Mm-hmm. But when they were younger, we started playing Dungeons and Dragons with them very early on. And when I say very early on, it's very shocking to people. We actually started with them when they were like 4, 3, 2.5. Mm. But one of our traditions as a homeschooling family was fitness and weapons training for our physical education. And one of our annual traditions that my children always look forward to is November 1st. And November 1st, following Halloween here in America, we have our jack-o'-lanterns and we take them in the backyard and we have live weapon training with these giant gourds. And every year we try to do a different theme, but almost always with sword, spear, and axe. And some years it's been throwing spears and some years it's been throwing axes. And then of course we had one year where we did apocalypse training where everyone got to use things like tire irons, baseball bats, things like that. So, but live weapon training is part of our family tradition, and has been an enjoyable part of our homeschooling and an extension of our gaming hobby. So those kind of things. And that's also interested my children in things like martial arts and fencing and those different activities. So you're absolutely right. Going in the backyard, maybe beat up some pumpkins on November 1st. Make sure they're your own pumpkins, not the neighborhood's pumpkins. And just have some fun, but do it safely and do it with an adult, right? So all of that is amazing. Spencer, one of the things that I'm excited to ask you about is historical African martial arts. Now, you talked about how we have these manuals for historical European martial arts that we can go back to from the 16th, 15th, 14th centuries, right? And with illustrations on stance and things like that. Now, do you have manuscripts like that for historical African martial arts?
So that's the interesting part. There's a lot of things where, as we look, and with the Historical African Martial Arts Association that I'm a part of, I'm more of its outreach and interviewer in the committee or the council. There's a lot that where it, there's some things written down, but it's in Arabic or more not in languages that we have access to. Mm-hmm. So we actually have to raise money, which we're non-for-profit, to get them transcribed over. Like we have something with the whole Mamluk project. So the fighters that were with Saladin when they fought Richard and the part of his like personal guard were some Africans, or they're called Mamluks. So there's some trees there that we have, but we don't have it translated. Other than that, there was a lot of passed down. That's the hard thing when we come to African martial arts. But a lot of people say they're like, I never knew Africa had a martial art. And you and I both know and think about D&D or anything. Wherever you have two humans or civilizations come, they're like, I want your stuff. You want my stuff. I got to protect my stuff. There's martial arts. Mm-hmm. So there are so many different levels of martial arts. And a common misconception is that the Africans didn't have use to steel or iron. They did. They actually did work on it. Now, they did not have some of the most refined techniques until later. But you think about within the Mali Empire with Mansa Musa, where he was the richest, arguably one of the richest people in the world, where they went actually and they did a little pilgrimages from Mali all the way to Mecca. And there's a story about where he had salt on his camels and all this other food and money. And he destabilized the whole government by giving too much stuff out to people that it made like everything inflate. And on his way back, he was like, oh, I got to fix this. I'll take it all back or buy it all back. Either way, how he fixed it. But anyway, so they had metal, they had different things. There's the Benin Empire. It goes on and on and on, which is hard for me. So I specialize in Egyptian and Ethiopian with the Shotel, the curved sword. People who look at my Instagram, the curved one, the Shotel is one of my favorite. And then the Kopesh, which is more of like a question mark, which is blade on one. That one's Egyptian. So there's just too much to have there to be a master of all of it. But we're starting to look at things. I mean, can you imagine Egyptian, like the hieroglyphics and looking at some of their pictures and actually then deciphering, trying to see what they use. And you're like, I think it was this way. And then we take the things and we go and do it. there's some things I'm working on right now and writing books on with the Ethiopian Shotel, where a lot of the experts now these days are like, I think they were purely ceremonial. They weren't used. And after we've looked and we found some actual historic ones or found some ancient ones, they're built a lot stronger than what most ceremonial weapons would be for. Now, are they kind of wonky and weird? Sure. But just like anything, you practice how to use them. So I think they were actually used to some degree. There's something called a trombosh, which is Congolese. And having that, and after I showed it to you, it's so thin and it's so different to where I think it's definitely ceremonial, because they call it a throwing dagger, to where if you threw this, you could maybe hurt somebody once or twice, but it's going to break. And most of the time, when you think about weapons, and you D&D people know as well, you want your weapons to have longevity and you want to be able to rely on it. You don't want to just have it break, because then you're in trouble fighting your goblin, ogre, whatever, or other bandits. And you're like, I don't want to have to think about, if I use this weapon, will it break? So long story short, there is some things, but we don't have access to it because we don't know how to read the language. But some of it, we're writing it ourselves. So I get to be a modern day Fiore, as we talked about, and write on some of my own things.
I think that is incredible. And, you know, I think a lot of people don't realize, unless they have actually taken the time to study historical Africa, they don't realize just how big of a continent it is, how many cultures there are, how many different styles of combat and war and tribal traditions. And like you mentioned, ritual weapons versus combat weapons. I mean, it is so rich and incredible. There are people, Egyptologists, who spend their whole lives just focused on that one country in that whole continent. And the fact that you are on the ground level bringing historical African martial arts to the forefront and popularize it as much as HEMA is just amazing. I don't know if you're aware of this. It's trending right now on Instagram and TikTok, but there is a Pan-African D&D supplement that a group is trying to put together. And it is basically taking all of this historical African culture and weapons and even mythology and magic and trying to make something that is really a Dungeons and Dragons in a historical, almost ancient or medieval Africa. And I have been following this, and I'm probably saying it wrong, but the project is called Zairo, Z-A-I-R-O-O. So folks who are listening, if I'm saying it wrong, make sure you let me know in the comments, right? But Zairo is this Pan-African fantasy setting, and they're going to make it accessible to people who play Dungeons and Dragons. And I think that's really incredible. I definitely think, Spencer, you are one of the people they should reach out to, because someone who is actually out there in the ring using these weapons, trying out these martial arts from Africa, should have a say in the combat system for this game. I'm just throwing that out.
I'd love to. I would love to. We've talked about money and things without being like, oh, if you talk to me, I want to get paid. No, just to share the information. I would love to have my hand in that, or at least get Sensei Damon or Chief Damon or just some people that know, because I'm really curious about that now.
That's awesome. That's awesome. And we'll put links to Zairo in the show notes, so anybody who's interested can jump in on that, because right now the Discord is on fire with conversation and discussion. And I just thought that historical African martial arts and this project would be a beautiful pairing. So I hope I hope we can bring that together.
Yeah.
Talking about combat and tabletop role-playing games, one of the things that is a heated debate among gamers is what is a good or the best combat system when going to different tabletop RPGs. And I'm going to be honest with you, my feeling as 30 years as a dungeon master is whatever is the most fun. But with Dungeons and Dragons, now in the current version, It's kind of more like a video game. You're rolling the D20. You're adding your modifier, and then you're seeing if you can hit over the person's armor class. And that's basically it. We're subtracting hit points. Very video game. There are other systems where you actually have attacks and parries. And one of the systems that I'm familiar with that does that is the Palladium Book system. Now, folks know Palladium Books for games like Rifts, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and Palladium Fantasy. Well, it's a much more complicated system of attack and parry, dodges. It gives you a lot more freedom of movement. And I think what's really great, and I try to bring that even to my Dungeons and Dragons games, what I try to do is I ask the player to describe how they're attacking. And what you'll do is when you give players the freedom, they'll actually describe things like, well, I'm going to use the terrain. I'm going to run up here on this broken wall. I'm going to jump up, and that's going to give me an advantage as I'm jumping down and swiping my sword at an angle, you know, those kind of things. And I want my players to think in those dimensions, because one, I want it not only for it to be entertaining for them, but I want it to be when we're doing these things with miniatures on a board or tokens on a screen, it's very important to have these cinematic descriptions for the players to be able to imagine what everyone's doing. So when it comes to tabletop combat versus actually in the ring, I think one of the biggest things is when you've got that helmet on, Spencer, and you are in a ring and you've got, you know, it's 2-on-2 or 4-on-4. I've watched some of your footage, and you'll be sword fighting with one guy, and then another guy will just come out from the side and just slam into you. What is it? Tell the folks at home what it's like to be in that helmet and kind of have some of your peripherals kind of diminished and you know, just being in that melee. What's that like?
Sure. And it's absolutely horrible. That's first of all, what he's describing is sometimes when we get to do for fun, some of these like all the alls, or we do 5v5s and we're doing some of the world competitions or in the States competitions, it's you are relying on your combatants or your teammates to kind of watch your six or watch your size, but things happen and then they get taken down. And you're not sure. Then you get sideswiped by somebody. And that makes me think of a story. The first time I started armored combat, and I can think of 2012, I was in like a big, it's not a barn, but we're fighting in kind of a, where you trade livestock, because we want to have the ground to be nice and soft, so it was dirt ground, and it was like a rink, because you don't want to hit the concrete, obviously, then you're hitting two levels of concussion. But I was doing something, and I was just green, even though I've been fighting the SCA since 2009, so I have like 6 years experience, not six, Matt, 4 years of experience. But I wasn't paying attention, and someone just came from behind me and just trucked me and just put me right into the dirt. And I was like, oh my goodness. And in this sport, once you're down, you stay down for those ones. So that's, it depends on different styles where, and I was just like, oh, you got to have your head on a swivel or you're not really sure. And first of all, for the people out there, your helmet really protects you. Which, I mean, goes without saying, we're like, well, duh, Spencer, your helmet's supposed to protect you. But in real life, when we actually have it, like I'm using, you can't see it, but you can hear I have right next to me. This is a big 14-gauge steel helm, and it has dents in it from sometimes I didn't block, but it's protected me from actually getting destroyed. And even though most people in general, they're not trying to hurt the people, it doesn't take a lot of pressure for those of you who like swing anything, a bat at a pumpkin that we talked about. It really does protect you. So it's fascinating, and you really think from a historical standpoint, I've been like, oh, maybe this is what it was like to be in a battle and then just get sideswiped by somebody you're not sure.
That's a terrifying feeling. I mean, I can imagine the adrenaline and the rush and then crashing down on the floor and being like, oh my gosh, I'm downed, and thinking, oh, well, thank goodness we're not fighting to the death, right? And it's like, oh my gosh. The other thing that I really try to drive home to players, and of course, you know, historical combat's very different from Dungeons and Dragons because we have things like magic and, you know, we got wizards being our artillery, dropping fireballs, things like that.
So cool.
Yes. But one of the things I try to drive home to players, and especially to my home table and my children, is to use tactics. Team tactics are so important. A game called Pathfinder really puts tactics into the game. You can get what they call feats, and you and the other players can share feats that give you advantages in combat, and it's tactical, actually using teamwork to overcome obstacles. And that's one of the things that we try to drive home. Now, you mentioned these five-on-five combats in tournaments. What are some of the teamwork or strategies or tactics that you guys use? Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure, sure. So it's so interesting. Me being Southern Illinois, I've been a duelist mostly, but I still am well-versed enough to fight on the five-on-five teams, or I was a world champion on the 16-16 teams with Team USA. Last thing, they just came back from Mexico recently, which I wasn't able to fight this time because it took money to do all these travels. So I sat this year out for fighting. But when you get into the 16-16s, the 5-on-5s, the 10-on-10s, you have to, you're limited by how big the field is. All the fields are not equal. When we were in Spain last year, the field was like the size of a football field. I kid you not. It was ginormous. And we still did the 5-on-5s in that one. We did the 16s and 16s, we did the 5-on-5. So Team USA, I was on the B string, so we were the second squad. So we had one guy named, his name was Zach Golden. I kid you not, he is like, I don't know, easily 400 pounds in armor. Maybe he's a big, burly, just dude. Like, if you're thinking as much as like a round orc, and he's just awesome, but he wasn't fast, right? Right. So when we first started, like, we let ourselves get strung out. And I think as Team Spain that time, they kicked our butts so bad. But the next one we came out, they were like, hey guys, let's hunker down in a corner. And I wasn't team captain, but sometimes I'll just call things out and we all just kind of listen. And like, we wanted to reach out. I was like, no, no, stay here, stay here. And the crowd started booing because we weren't chasing them, but we were going to get torn apart. So we hunkered down off the corner off of Zach in the corner. We were like, come to us. And I literally drew a line in the sand and somebody came and did something. We had some funny antics back and forth. I think we managed to win that one, but we ended up being beat the second time. But, it was really just amazing. So you have to think about who you're only as fast as your slowest person. What are your strengths? What are we working on? And that made me think about the system you said before this. Was it Palladium? It's not Palladium.
Palladium, yep. Or and Palladium. Palladium's got the parry and the dodge and the attacks. And then Pathfinder has the teamwork feats.
And the Pathfinder has the teamwork and feats. Palladium, I think, is really interesting, where one day I want to do a D&D game where we have all people that are fighters that actually fight and use a system like that, and maybe have a DM such as yourself. I think it'd be really fun. But Pathfinder, too, where we talk about these feats, this is where your training that's off-board, off-screen, that's what you get to amass, and that's what you actually understand. So if you ever have any kind of questioning, why is this really in the game? Does this feel realistic? Ultimately, when it comes down to real fight, it comes down to tactics, the conditioning, the training that you've done, but then what experiences you had. Because even though I don't get to fight with teams that have teams of 5 or 10 people where they get to fight all the time, I've fought enough combat now to where you tell me what the plan is, I've done enough personal conditioning, and I can just kind of, I call myself a six man, like people that like football or basketball. I just try to be a good six man to where I can just jump into any team. And it's just really fun. It's really fun.
That's awesome, Spencer. And I love that. You know what? That goes right back to tabletop, where you're leveling up, right? Your experience has given you the advantages that when you're in these situations, you can fit into a new group of fighters, a new combat scenario, and you can be like, okay, from my experience, I know things go like this. So if you say, let's do this strategy, I'm down for that. And I know how to do that. And that I know where I fit in as good support. And that's amazing. So just Spencer, just terrific stuff coming there. And I think, you know, one of the things that we miss out on in tabletop is a lot of people like to talk about the backstory of the hero, right? The hero's journey, the tragic backstory, whatever you have going on that led you to this life of adventuring. But I think one of the things that Dungeon Masters miss as an opportunity is the training montage. In every film, you got to see that training montage, right? That drives home, look, you were like this and now you're like this. And one of the things that I did for a group that we had a long-term campaign in is they were leveling up. Well, we had a unique situation that I never had before as a dungeon master. The player selected a creature that he wanted to be. And we looked at the rules and found out that, ooh, if he is this creature, he's actually the equivalent of a fourth level human fighter from the go. So what we did was we went ahead and we broke his creature. We broke his abilities up and he leveled up as that creature for four levels. And then by the fourth level, he got to actually choose a character class, which is very different, right? So most role-playing games, you pick your type, your race, your creature, and then you pick your class. But he had to wait four levels before he got to do that. And one of the things that put me in a unique situation was people were saying, well, you can't just, you know, slice your sword through a goblin and then suddenly you are a trained fighter. So how are we going to explain that he's gone from this hulking beast to this, you know, sophisticated swordsman? And so what we did was we waited till he reached fourth level and then we had a training montage where he met a mentor who trained him and we did all that. And it was all kind of like a cutscene and then explained now this is why he's able to use a sword and a shield and armor and all these things. So that was unique for me. But even moving forward as a dungeon master, it taught me that that training montage is very important for the players so that they really understand what leveling up means and how it affects their hero. You're getting ready for a big fight in Nashville, Tennessee. So you are training. It's coming this June, and you are preparing for that tournament. What does a window into your training montage look like for the folks at home?
So I'll be honest on this one. It may be kind of boring to some people. Like now for sword fighting, I've got all the basics down. However, there's always room for improvement. However, I have enough with that. Right now, this fight that I'm about to go into is like an MMA fight where we're all wearing armor. There are certain rules. I'm doing an axe fight. So we're actually fighting with axes. So this is one of the few times to where you could actually get knocked out if you could. And that would be safe. But like for you, since you're there, like the head of this axe is a little bit smaller, but it's on like a 6-foot shaft. So this, it has the mass and still the velocity. Where if it hits my helmet unblocked, I'm like, oh, it's going to actually stun me and it can have difference. Opposed to this bigger axe that I have that I can still use. So you can go and you can kind of switch. It's kind of like golfing, but you're playing with hitting other people. And you're like, I need my six axe or my six iron. But I haven't trained a lot of cardio because in this armor, people wear armor anywhere from 40 to 80 pounds of armor. My stuff is titanium, so it's a lot lighter. It's on the lighter side. However, it does not take the abuse. But I need to block my shots. I need to block and parry. Otherwise, it will get dented. Titanium will keep me from being hurt. But the percussive force of the physics of when it hits titanium will actually crease it, especially with that axe head. So I still don't really want to get hit that much. Just like, once again, people are like, well, Dustin, sir, I don't want to get hit either. But it's different. It is a cage match. So we have like an octagon, kind of like an MMA. And I believe they're either two-minute rounds or three-minute rounds, and it goes to max of three rounds. But this one, the axe is pretty destructive. But yet we're still going to be safe. We still have the mechanics and stuff will protect us, but it's pretty brutal. So the day of training is really just doing a lot of cardio, working on swinging with other axe I'm going to use. I have my gauntlets here to talk about. I can go to the gym sometime. I could probably get away with bringing my whole armor, but as people, I don't want to get kicked out. So I don't know this gym super well, but I go in my backyard after I get done with doing my regular cardio working on and at least have my gauntlets and my helmet on when I do it, because it's different than swinging if I was just swinging my axe. Can I still practice with just swinging with my bare hands? Sure. But that's really the minimum for what you're practicing with. And we use tires a lot because tires, they don't look glorious. They don't look medieval and amazing, but you're not going to destroy a tire with an axe, at least right away. And these are all not sharp once again. But if you guys look at my video on Instagram, I have one where my dad was actually, because I'm helping my parents around the house still sometimes, I come in to visit them. And my dad's like, is there any physical work I can do? Talk about the training montage. Like, there's a tree that needs to come down. And I was like, oh, sweet. All this is a perfect instance for me to take a video. And I was chopping it down with my non-sharpened axe. It took a lot longer, but metal beats wood still. Mm-hmm. And people were like, why are you attacking the tree? I'm like, wait, don't get mad at me. The tree needs to come down anyway. But I wanted to show the difference between a sharpened axe and a non-sharpened axe. And yeah, so I know I went on a tangent there, but
no,
a lot of cardio wins, but then just actually getting familiar with the weapon that you're going to be using.
And I wanted to follow that up with, I think especially coming from a tabletop standpoint, when we think of melee fighters, we think of the fighter, we think of the barbarian, we think of the paladin, right? And the game system is designed for strength, right? Strength is the stat most associated with melee combat. It gives you bonuses to your damage and things like that. But what you're talking about with cardio, I mean, that's constitution. That's stamina. That's being able to make it through the rounds at the tournament in Nashville this June. So is that a secret strategy that you're working on there, Spencer, where the other guys are in the gym pushing big weights and you're like, well, if they neglect the cardio, they won't be able to make it through rounds 2, 3, and 4. So is that part of your strategy?
I think so, definitely. I mean, I'm a big dude, and actually for this fight, I'm having to fight down. I had to lose weight to get to there. I normally sit around 280 or so, but I need to get back down to my 260. We're fighting at 260, so I had to lose 20 pounds anyway before this fight. And for your viewers looking at, I'm still kind of lean, but I'm just a big dude. But if you don't have the cardio, yes, if the person's really strong and they hit you, that stinks. But you can still block, because it's not a real anime. People do swing really fast, don't get me wrong. But mostly, if you're in a defensive stance, from learning historical swordplay, from learning all these other manuscripts, you can mitigate your chances of being hit. But after you get a point, if you run out of gas, you're just in trouble. And any of you at home, if you have a punching bag, or don't punch your siblings or significant other or anything like that, but it's just a punching bag. If you punch that for a straight minute, for as hard as you can and work on, untrained people will get tired. Mm-hmm. And you got to do that 3 different rounds where, yes, most people are not trying to hurt you, but in this one, we are fighting. There's a prize on the line. We get to fight for, they're actually paying now, which is nice. We get 600 for coming up and showing up anyway. And then if you win, you get 100 on top of that. So we're actually, which is cool. That's why when I say professional swordsman now, it sounds so nerdy. We're like, I'm a professional swordsman, but that's what we are. And it's pretty cool. Or fighter at this point.
That is incredible. Spencer, we are so excited. We're excited about the fight in Nashville. And tell us what that's called and when exactly it's going to be again.
Sure. AMMA, so think Armored Mixed Martial Arts. I know it gets confusing with all these different kind of factions of swordplay. You talk about armored combat, Buhurt, but this one is specifically Armored Mixed Martial Arts. It's going to be in Nashville, Tennessee. This is specific to Nashville. There is a group of men and women that have been growing this from the ground up in their area. It's amazing. They started off just by doing shows in their own little fight group, and now they were fighting at the place called Nashville Palace. And now we're actually at a grand auditorium where I think it sits up to like 10,000 people. But most of the time we pull around 1,000 or so. But AMMA, it's going to be on June 8th. They do 6 fights a year now or 6 events a year. And the card on this one, I think we have 6 exhibition fights, where it's just people that are new getting started. They'll still be fighting different weapons apart. And then we have 6 what we call pro fights, a big fight, and I'll be on the card. And I'll make sure to link that with Raised on D&D later. They haven't showed my card yet. I think it's going to come out soon. But yeah, it's going to be pretty awesome. They're doing pay-per-view, so they're not doing live footing this because they're trying to make their money too. And people say, like, oh, they're just worried about the money. And it's like, no, it's a job at this point. They've done all these things. They've got to pay the bills, keep the lights on. So there'll still be footage afterwards, though.
Awesome. That is fantastic. Spencer, I feel like we could talk all day about combat and weapons and history, and we've just scratched the surface. I can't thank you enough for what you're putting out there on Simply Samurai. It is very inspirational. I hope the folks at home listening are going to take the broomsticks to the backyard and safely practice some of the things they do at the game table.
I just want to say, even as a world champion swordsman or fighter myself, I have lost many times. It happens. So just the same thing in real life. When you feel like you're getting beaten up, just cure yourself, like reaffirm yourself that you're still awesome, that you can do this, and build yourself back up and get out there, especially if it's something you really love, no matter what it is. I think that's something that D&D teaches us too as well. It's not as drastic as having to roll a new character, but something like that. And if you guys really like what we're talking about here, please follow me. Please follow him. Keep on following Nick and all the awesome work that they're doing. And if you want to see my D&D game, I would love to be a part sometime. So I will shamelessly plug that.
You are on the invite list, Spencer, for sure, man. I'm a pro dungeon master now, and I run games on startplaying.games, and I run free games on Roll20 all the time, and I will definitely get with you. Maybe after you're done training for this tournament, we can get together and roll some dice.
Perfectly. And sometimes my time even hire you for that all fighter group. So thank you so much once again for the opportunity.
Thank you for joining us on another episode of Raised on D&D Podcast. Be sure to subscribe and follow on all your favorite apps and social media.